Root played the organ every Sunday morning at the First Presbyterian Church. He wrote opera critiques for the Chicago Tribune. He read broadly in philosophy, science, art, and religion, and was known throughout Chicago's upper echelon for his ability to converse on almost any subject, and to do so with great wit. His conversational powers were extraordinary, a friend said. There seemed to be no subject which he had not investigated and in which he was not profoundly learned. He had a sly sense of humor. One Sunday morning he played the organ with particular gravity. It was a while before anyone noticed he was playing Shoe Fly. When Burnham and Root were together, one woman said, I used always to think of some big, strong tree with lightning playing around it. Each man recognized and respected the other's skills. The resultant harmony was reflected in the operation of their office, which, according to one historian, functioned with the mechanical precision of a slaughterhouse. An apt allusion given Burnham's close professional and personal association with the stockyards. But Burnham also created an office culture that anticipated that of businesses that would not appear for another century. He installed a gym. During lunch hour, employees played handball. Burnham gave fencing lessons. Root played impromptu recitals on a rented piano. The office was full of a rush of work, Sterrett said, but the spirit of the place was delightfully free and easy and human in comparison with other offices I had worked in. Burnham knew that together he and Root had reached a level of success neither could have achieved on his own. The synchrony with which they worked allowed them to take on ever more challenging and daring projects, at a time when so much that an architect did was new, and when dramatic increases in the height and weight of buildings amplified the risk of catastrophic failure. Harriet Monroe wrote, "The work of each man became constantly more necessary to the other." As the firm grew, so did the city. It got bigger, taller, richer, but it also grew dirtier, darker, and more dangerous. A miasma of cinder-flecked smoke blackened its streets and at times reduced visibility to the distance of a single block, especially in winter with coal furnaces in full roar. The ceaseless passage of trains, grip cars, trolleys, and carriages, surreys, landaus, Victorias, broughams, phaetons, and hearses, all with ironclad wheels that struck the pavement like rolling hammers, produced a constant thunder that did not recede until after midnight, and made the open window nights of summer unbearable. In poor neighborhoods, garbage mounded in alleys and overflowed giant trash boxes that became banquet halls for rats and bluebottle flies. Billions of flies. The corpses of dogs, cats, and horses often remained where they fell. In January, they froze into disheartening poses. In August, they ballooned and ruptured. Many ended up in the Chicago River, the city's main commercial artery. During heavy rains, the water of the river flowed in a greasy plume far out into Lake Michigan, to the towers that marked the intake pipes for the city's drinking water. In rain, any street not paved with macadam oozed a fragrant muck of horse manure, mud, and garbage that swelled between granite blocks like pus from a wound. Chicago awed visitors and terrified them. French editor Octave Uzan called it that Gordian city, so excessive, so satanic. Paul Lindau, an author and publisher, described it as a gigantic peep show of utter horror, but extraordinarily to the point. Burnham loved Chicago for the opportunity it afforded, but he grew wary of the city itself. By 1886, he and Margaret were the parents of five children, two daughters and three sons, the last a boy named Daniel, born in February. That year, Burnham bought an old farmhouse on the lake in the quiet village of Evanston, called by some the Athens of suburbs. The house had 16 rooms on 2 floors, was surrounded by superb old trees, and occupied a long rectangle of land that stretched to the lake. He bought it despite initial opposition from his wife and her father, and did not tell his own mother of his planned move until the purchase was complete. Later, he wrote her an apology. "I did it," he explained, "because I can no longer bear to have my children in the streets of Chicago." Success came easily to Burnham and Root, but the partners did have their trials. In 1885, a fire destroyed the Granis Block, their flagship structure. At least one of them was in the office at the time and made his escape down a burning stairway. They moved next to the top floor of the Rookery. 3 years later, a hotel they had designed in Kansas City collapsed during construction, injuring several men and killing one. Burnham was heartbroken. The city convened a coroner's inquest, which focused its attention on the building's design. For the first time in his career, Burnham found himself facing public attack. Burnham wrote to his wife, "You must not worry over the affair, no matter what the papers say. There will no doubt be censure and much trouble before we get through, all of which we will shoulder in a simple, straightforward, manly way. So much as in us lies." The experience cut him deeply, in particular the fact his competence lay exposed to the review of a bureaucrat over whom he had no influence. "The coroner," he wrote Margaret 3 days after the collapse, "is a disagreeable little doctor, a political hack without brains who distresses me." Burnham was sad and lonesome and wanted to go home. "I do so long to be there and be at peace again with you." A third blow came in this period, but of a different character. Although Chicago was rapidly achieving recognition as an industrial and mercantile dynamo, its leading men felt keenly the slander from New York that their city had few cultural assets. To help address this lack, one prominent Chicagoan, Ferdinand W. Peck, proposed to build an auditorium so big, so acoustically perfect, as to silence all the carping from the East and make a profit to boot. Peck envisioned enclosing this gigantic theater within a still larger shell that would contain a hotel, banquet room, and offices. The many architects who dined at Kinsley's restaurant, which had a stature in Chicago equal to that of Delmonico's in New York, agreed this would be the single most important architectural assignment in the city's history, and that most likely it would go to Burnham and Root. Burnham believed likewise. Peck chose Chicago architect Dankmar Adler. If acoustically flawed, Peck knew, the building would be a failure no matter how imposing the finished structure proved to be. Only Adler had previously demonstrated a clear grasp of the principles of acoustical design. "Burnham was not pleased," wrote Lewis Sullivan, by now Adler's partner, "nor was John Root precisely entranced. When Root saw early drawings of the auditorium, he said it appeared as if Sullivan was about to smear another facade with ornament." From the start, there was tension between the two firms, although no one could have known it would erupt years later in a caustic attack by Sullivan on Burnham's greatest achievements. This after Sullivan's own career had dissolved in a mist of alcohol and regret. For now, the tension was subtle, a vibration, like the inaudible cry of overstressed steel. It arose from discordant beliefs about the nature and purpose of architecture. Sullivan saw himself as an artist first, an idealist. In his autobiography, in which he always referred to himself in the third person, he described himself as an innocent with his heart wrapped up in the arts, in the philosophies, in the religions, in the beatitudes of nature's loveliness, in his search for the reality of man, in his profound faith in the beneficence of power. He called Burnham a colossal merchandiser, fixated on building the biggest, tallest, costliest structures. He was elephantine, tactless, and blurting. Workers began building the auditorium on June 1, 1887. The result was an opulent structure that, for the moment, was the biggest private building in America. Its theater contained over 4,000 seats, 1,200 more than New York's Metropolitan Opera House. And it was air-conditioned through a system that blew air over ice. The surrounding building had commercial offices, an immense banquet hall, and a hotel with 400 luxurious rooms. A traveler from Germany recalled that by simply turning an electric dial on the wall by his bed, he could request towels, stationery, ice water, newspaper, whiskey, or a shoe shine. It became the most celebrated building in Chicago. The President of the United States, Benjamin Harrison, attended its grand opening. Ultimately, these setbacks proved to be minor ones for Burnham and Root. Far worse was to occur, and soon. But as of February 14, 1890, the day of the great fair vote, the partners seemed destined for a lifetime of success. Outside the Tribune building, there was silence. The crowd needed a few moments to process the news. A man in a long beard was one of the first to react. He had sworn not to cut the beard until Chicago got the fair. Now he climbed the steps of the adjacent Union Trust Company bank. On the top step, he let out a shriek that one witness likened to the scream of a skyrocket. Others in the crowd echoed his cry, and soon 2,000 men and women and a few children, mostly telegraph boys and hired messengers, cut loose with a cheer that tore through the canyon of brick, stone, and glass like a flash flood. The messenger boys raced off with the news, while throughout the city, telegraph boys sprinted from the offices of the Postal Telegraph Company and Western Union, or leapt aboard their Pope safety bikes, one bound for the Grand Pacific Hotel, another the Palmer House, others to the Richelieu, Auditorium, Wellington, the gorgeous homes on Michigan and Prairie, the clubs, Chicago, Century, Union League, and the expensive brothels, in particular, Carrie Watson's place with its lovely young women and cascades of champagne. One telegraph boy made his way through the dark to an unlit alley that smelled of rotted fruit and was silent save for the receding hiss of gas lights on the street he had left behind. He found a door and knocked and entered a room full of men, some young, some old, all seeming to speak at once, a few quite drunk. A coffin at the center of the room served as a bar. The light was dim and came from gas jets hidden behind skulls mounted on the walls. Other skulls lay scattered about the room. A hangman's noose dangled from the wall, as did assorted weapons and a blanket caked with blood. These artifacts marked the room as headquarters of the Whitechapel Club, named for the London slum in which 2 years earlier Jack the Ripper had done his killing. The club's president held the official title, The Ripper. Its members were mainly journalists, who brought to the club's meetings stories of murder harvested from the city's streets. The weapons on the wall had been used in actual homicides and were provided by Chicago policemen, the skulls by an alienist at a nearby lunatic asylum, the blanket by a member who acquired it while covering a battle between the army and the Sioux. Upon learning that Chicago had won the fair, the men of the Whitechapel Club composed a telegram to Chauncey Depew, who more than any other man symbolized New York and its campaign to win the fair. Previously, Depew had promised the members of the Whitechapel Club that if Chicago prevailed, he would present himself at the club's next meeting, to be hacked apart by the Ripper himself. Metaphorically, he presumed, although with the Whitechapel Club, could one ever be certain? The club's coffin, for example, had once been used to transport the body of a member who had committed suicide. After claiming his body, the club hauled it to the Indiana Dunes on Lake Michigan, where members erected an immense pyre. They placed the body at the top, then set it alight. They carried torches and wore black hooded robes and circled the fire, singing hymns to the dead between sips of whiskey. The club also had a custom of dispatching members in their black robes to kidnap visiting celebrities and steal them away in a black coach with covered windows. All this without saying a word. The club's telegram reached Depew in Washington 20 minutes after the final ballot, just as Chicago's delegation began celebrating at the Willard Hotel near the White House. The telegram asked, "When may we see you at our dissecting table?" Depew sent an immediate response. "I am at your service when ordered and quite ready after today's events to contribute my body to Chicago science." Although gracious in acknowledging defeat, Depew in fact doubted Chicago really understood the challenge that lay ahead. "The most marvelous exhibit of modern times, or ancient times, has now just closed successfully at Paris," he told the Tribune. "Whatever you do is to be compared with that. If you equal it, you have made a success. If you surpass it, you have made a triumph. If you fall below it, you will be held responsible by the whole American people for having assumed what you are not equal to." "Beware," he warned. "Take care." Chicago promptly established a formal corporation, the World's Columbian Exposition Company, to finance and build the fair. Quietly, officials made it clear that Burnham and Root would be the lead designers. The burden of restoring the nation's pride and prominence in the wake of the Paris Exposition had fallen upon Chicago, and Chicago, in turn, had lodged it firmly, if for now discreetly, on the top floor of the rookery. Failure was unthinkable. If the fair failed, Burnham knew, the nation's honor would be tarnished, Chicago humiliated, and his own firm dealt a crushing blow. Everywhere Burnham turned, there was someone, a friend, an editor, a fellow club member, telling him that the nation expected something tremendous out of this fair, and expected it in record time. The auditorium alone had taken nearly 3 years to build and driven Lewis Sullivan to the brink of physical collapse. Now Burnham and Root were being called upon to build what amounted to an entire city in about the same amount of time. Not just any city, but one that would surpass the brilliance of the Paris Exposition. The fair also would have to make a profit. Among Chicago's leading men, profitability was a matter of personal and civic honor. By traditional architectural standards, the challenge seemed an impossible one. Alone, neither architect could do it, but together, Burnham believed, he and Root had the will and the interlocking powers of organization and design to succeed. Together they had defeated gravity and conquered the soft gumbo of Chicago soil to change forever the character of urban life. Now, together, they would build the fair and change history. It could be done, because it had to be done. But the challenge was monstrous. Depew's oratory on the fair quickly grew tiresome, but the man had a way of capturing with wit and brevity the true character of a situation. "Chicago is like the man who marries a woman with a ready-made family of 12," he said. "The trouble is just begun." Even Depew, however, did not foresee the true magnitude of the forces converging on Burnham and Root. At this moment, he and they saw the challenge only in its two most fundamental dimensions, time and money, and these were stark enough. Only Poe could have dreamed the rest. The Necessary Supply. One morning in August 1886, as heat rose from the streets with the intensity of a child's fever, a man calling himself H.H. Holmes walked into one of Chicago's train stations. The air was stale and still, suffused with the scent of rotted peaches, horse excrement and partially combusted Illinois anthracite. Half a dozen locomotives stood in the train yard, exhaling steam into the already yellow sky. Holmes acquired a ticket to a village called Englewood in the town of Lake, a municipality of 200,000 people that abutted what was then Chicago's southernmost boundary. The township encompassed the Union Stockyards and two large parks, Washington Park, with lawns, gardens, and a popular racetrack, and Jackson Park, a desolate, undeveloped waste on the lakeshore. Despite the heat, Holmes looked fresh and crisp. As he moved through the station, the glances of young women fell around him like wind-blown petals. He walked with confidence and dressed well, conjuring an impression of wealth and achievement. He was 26 years old. His height was 5 feet 8 3/4 inches. He weighed only 155 pounds. He had dark hair and striking blue eyes, once likened to the eyes of a mesmerist. "The eyes are very big and wide open," a physician named John L. Capon later observed. "They are blue. Great murderers, like great men in other walks of activity, have blue eyes." Capon also noted thin lips tinted by a full, dark mustache. What he found most striking were Holmes's ears. "It is a marvelously small ear, and at the top it is shaped and carved after the fashion in which old sculptors indicated deviltry and vice in their statues of satyrs. Overall," Capon noted, "he is made on a very delicate mold." To women as yet unaware of his private obsessions, it was an appealing delicacy. He broke prevailing rules of casual intimacy. He stood too close, stared too hard, touched too much and long. And women adored him for it. He stepped from the train into the heart of Englewood and took a moment to survey his surroundings. He stood at the intersection of 63rd and Wallace. A telegraph pole at the corner held fire alarm box number 2475. In the distance rose the frames of several three-story homes under construction. He heard the concussion of hammers. Newly planted trees stood in soldierly ranks, but in the heat and haze they looked like desert troops gone too long without water. The air was still, moist, and suffused with the burned licorice scent of freshly rolled macadam. On the corner stood a shop with a sign identifying it as E.S. Holton Drugs. He walked. He came to Wentworth Street, which ran north and south and clearly served as Englewood's main commercial street, its pavement clotted with horses, drays, and phaetons. Near the corner of 63rd and Wentworth, he passed a fire station that housed Engine Company No. 51. Next door was a police station. Years later, a villager with a blind spot for the macabre would write, "While at times there was considerable need of a police force in the Stockyards district, Englewood pursued the even tenor of its way with very little necessity for their appearance, other than to ornament the landscape and see that the cows were not disturbed in their peaceful pastures." Holmes returned to Wallace Street, where he had seen the sign for Holton Drugs. Tracks crossed the intersection. A guard sat squinting against the sun watching for trains, and every few minutes lowered a crossing gate as yet another locomotive huffed past. The drugstore was on the northwest corner of Wallace and 63rd. Across Wallace was a large vacant lot. Holmes entered the store and there found an elderly woman named Mrs. Holton. He sensed vulnerability. Sensed it the way another man might capture the trace of a woman's perfume. He identified himself as a doctor and licensed pharmacist and asked the woman if she needed assistance in her store. He spoke softly and smiled often and held her in his frank blue gaze. He was good with conversation, and soon she revealed to him her deepest sorrow, Her husband, upstairs in their apartment, was dying of cancer. She confessed that managing the store while caring for him had become a great burden. Holmes listened with moist eyes. He touched her arm. He could ease her burden, he said. Not only that, he could turn the drugstore into a thriving establishment and conquer the competition up the block. His gaze was so clear and blue. She told him she would have to talk to her husband. She walked upstairs. The day was hot. Flies rested on the windowsill. Outside, yet another train rumbled through the intersection. Cinder and smoke like soiled gauze drifted past the window. She would talk to her husband, yes. But he was dying, and she was the one who now managed the store and bore its responsibilities, and she had come to a decision. There was a warm attentiveness about the young doctor that could lighten her days in the hard time ahead when she would lose her husband. That she would lose him was beyond doubt. Daily he seemed to shrink within his bedclothes. His sleep had grown fitful. He would wake with the passing of each train. On these hot nights, closing the windows was unthinkable, and she lay there in the moist, iron-filled dark, fearing a future alone. Just thinking about the young doctor, seeing those kind blue eyes, gave her a feeling of contentment she had not experienced in a long while. Holmes had been to Chicago before, but only for brief visits. The city impressed him, he said later, which was surprising because, as a rule, nothing impressed him. Nothing moved him. Events and people captured his attention the way moving objects caught the notice of an amphibian. First, a machine-like registration of proximity, next, a calculation of worth, last, a decision to act or remain motionless. When he resolved at last to move to Chicago, he was still using his given name, Herman Webster Mudgett. As for most people, his initial sensory contact with Chicago had been the fantastic stink that lingered always in the vicinity of the Union Stockyards, a chinook of putrefaction and incinerated hair. An elemental odor, wrote Upton Sinclair, raw and crude. It was rich, almost rancid, sensual, and strong. Most people found it repulsive. The few who found it invigorating tended to be men who had waded in its river of death, Sinclair's phrase, and panned from it great fortunes. It is tempting to imagine that all that death and blood made Mudgett feel welcome, but more realistic to suppose it merely conveyed a sense that here at last was a city that allowed a broader range of behavior than was tolerated in Gilmanton Academy, New Hampshire, the town in which he was born and where he drifted through childhood as a small, odd, and exceptionally bright boy, and where, as a consequence, in the cruel imaginations of his peers, he became prey. The memory of one episode stayed with him throughout his life. He was 5, wearing his first boy's suit, when his parents sent him off to begin his education at the village schoolhouse. I had daily to pass the office of one village doctor, the door of which was seldom, if ever, barred, he wrote in a later memoir. Partly from its being associated in my mind as the source of all the nauseous mixtures that had been my childish terror, for this was before the day of children's medicines, and partly because of vague rumors I had heard regarding its contents, this place was one of peculiar abhorrence to me. In those days, a doctor's office could indeed be a fearsome place. All doctors were, in a sense, amateurs. The best of them bought cadavers for cash, no questions asked, and preserved particularly interesting bits of diseased viscera in large clear bottles. Skeletons hung in offices for easy anatomical reference. Some transcended function to become works of art, so detailed, so precisely articulated. Every bleached bone hitched to its neighbor with brass under a skull grinning with slap-shoulder bonhomie, that they appeared ready to race chattering down the street to catch the next grip car. Two older children discovered Mudgett's fear and one day captured him and dragged him, struggling and shrieking, into the doctor's office. Nor did they desist, Mudgett wrote, until I had been brought face to face with one of its grinning skeletons, which, with arms outstretched, seemed ready in its turn to seize me. It was a wicked and dangerous thing to do to a child of tender years and health, he wrote, but it proved an heroic method of treatment, destined ultimately to cure me of my fears and to inculcate in me, first, a strong feeling of curiosity, and later a desire to learn, which resulted years afterwards in my adopting medicine as a profession. The incident probably did occur, but with a different choreography. More likely, the two older boys discovered their 5-year-old victim did not mind the excursion, that far from struggling and shrieking, he merely gazed at the skeleton with cool appreciation. When his eyes settled back upon his captors, it was they who fled. Gilmanton was a small farming village in New Hampshire's Lake Country, sufficiently remote that its residents did not have access to a daily newspaper and rarely heard the shriek of train whistles. Mudgett had 2 siblings, a brother and sister. His father Levi was a farmer, as was Levi's own father. Mudgett's parents were devout Methodists whose response to even routine misbehavior relied heavily on the rod and prayer, followed by banishment to the attic and a day with neither speech nor food. His mother often insisted he pray with her in her room, then filled the air around him with trembly passion. By his own assessment, he was a mother's boy. He spent a good deal of time alone in his room reading Jules Verne and Edgar Allan Poe and inventing things. He built a wind-powered mechanism that generated noise to scare birds from the family fields and set out to create a perpetual motion machine. He hid his most favored treasures in small boxes, among them his first extracted tooth and a photograph of his 12-year-old sweetheart. Although later observers speculated these boxes also contained treasures of a more macabre sort, such as the skulls of small animals that he disabled and then dissected alive in the woods around Gilmanton. They based this speculation on the hard lessons learned during the 20th century about the behavior of children of similar character. Mudgett's only close friend was an older child named Tom, killed in a fall while the boys were playing in an abandoned house. Mudgett gouged his initials into an old elm tree at his grandfather's farm, where the family marked his growth with notches and a door jamb. The first was less than 3 feet high. One of his favorite pastimes was to hike to a high boulder and shout to generate an echo. He ran errands for an itinerant photographer who stopped for a time in Gilmanton. The man had a pronounced limp and was glad for the help. One morning the photographer gave Mudgett a broken block of wood and asked him to take it to the town wagon maker for a replacement. When Mudgett returned with the new block, he found the photographer sitting beside his door, partly clothed. Without preamble, the photographer removed one of his legs. Mudgett was stunned. He had never seen an artificial limb before and watched keenly as the photographer inserted the new block into a portion of the leg. Had he next proceeded to remove his head in the same mysterious way, I should not have been further surprised, Mudgett wrote. Something about Mudgett's expression caught the photographer's eye. Still on one leg, he moved to his camera and prepared to take Mudgett's picture. Just before he opened the shutter, he held up his artificial leg and waved it at the boy. Several days later, he gave Mudgett the finished photograph. I kept it for many years, Mudgett wrote, and the thin, terror-stricken face of that barefooted, homespun-clad boy I can yet see. At the time Mudgett described this encounter in his memoir, he was sitting in a prison cell hoping to engineer a swell of public sympathy. While it is charming to imagine the scene, the fact is the cameras that existed during Mudgett's boyhood made candid moments almost impossible to capture, especially when the subject was a child. If the photographer saw anything in Mudgett's eyes, it was a pale blue emptiness that he knew, to his sorrow, no existing film could ever record. At 16, Mudgett graduated school and, despite his age, took a job as a teacher, first in Gilmanton and then in Alton, New Hampshire, where he met a young woman named Clara A. Lovering. She had never encountered anyone quite like Mudgett. He was young but poised and had a knack for making her feel good even when she was inclined to feel otherwise. He spoke so well and with such warmth, always touching her in small, affectionate ways, even in public. His great flaw was his persistent demand that she allow him to make love to her, not as a lover in formal courtship, but in that way that was supposed to come only after marriage. She held him off but could not deny that Mudgett aroused within her an intensity of desire that colored her dreams. Mudgett was 18 when he asked her to elope. She agreed. They married July 4, 1878, before a justice of the peace. At first there was passion far beyond what the dour gossip of older women had led Clara to expect, but their relationship chilled rapidly. Mudgett left the house for long periods. Soon he was gone for days at a time. Finally, he was just gone. In the wedding registry of Alton, New Hampshire, they remained married, their contract a legal, if desiccated, thing. At 19, Mudgett went to college. Initially, he set his sights on Dartmouth, but changed his mind and went instead directly into medical school. He enrolled first in the medicine program at the University of Vermont in Burlington, but found the school too small and after only 1 year moved to the University of Michigan in Ann Arbor, one of the West's leading scientific medical schools, noted for its emphasis on the controversial art of dissection. He enrolled on September 21, 1882. During the summer of his junior year, he committed what he called, in his memoir, "The first really dishonest act of my life." He took a job as a traveler for a book publisher, assigned to sell a single book throughout northwestern Illinois. Instead of turning in the proceeds, he kept them. At the end of the summer, he returned to Michigan. "I could hardly count my western trip a failure," he wrote, "for I had seen Chicago." He graduated in June 1884 with a lackluster record and set out to find some favorable location in which to launch a practice. To do so, he took another job as a traveler, this time with a nursery company based in Portland, Maine. His route took him through towns he might otherwise never have encountered. Eventually, he came to Moore's Forks, New York, where, according to the Chicago Tribune, the trustees of the Moore's Forks grade school, impressed with Mudgett's gentlemanly manners, hired him as the school principal, a post he held until he at last opened a medical practice. "Here I stayed for 1 year doing good and conscientious work, for which I received plenty of gratitude, but little or no money." Wherever he went, troubling things seemed to occur. His professors in Michigan had little to say about his academic talents, but recalled that he had distinguished himself in a different way. "Some of the professors here recollected him as being a scamp," the university said. "He had a breach of promise with a hairdresser, a widow, who came to Ann Arbor from St. Louis, Michigan." In Moore's Forks, there were rumors that a boy seen in his company had disappeared. Mudgett claimed the boy had returned to his own home in Massachusetts. No investigation took place. No one could imagine the charming Dr. Mudgett causing harm to anyone, let alone a child. At midnight, many nights, Mudgett would pace the street outside his lodging. Mudgett needed money. Teaching had paid a poverty wage. His medical practice yielded an income only slightly larger. In the fall of 1885, he wrote, starvation was staring me in the face. While in medical school, he and a fellow student, a Canadian, had talked about how easy it would be for one of them to buy life insurance, make the other the beneficiary, then use a cadaver to fake the death of the one insured. In Moore's, the idea came back to Mudgett. He paid a visit to his former classmate and found that his financial condition was no better. Together, they devised an elaborate life insurance fraud, which Mudgett described in his memoir. It was an impossibly complex and gruesome plan, likely beyond the powers of anyone to execute, but his description is noteworthy for what it revealed, without his intention, about his astigmatic soul. Broadly stated, the plan called for Holmes and his friend to recruit a couple of other accomplices, who together would fake the deaths of a family of three and substitute cadavers for each person. The bodies would turn up later in an advanced state of decomposition, and the conspirators would divide the $40,000 death benefit, equivalent to over $1 million in 21st century valuation. The scheme called for a considerable amount of material, Mudgett wrote, no less than three bodies, in fact, meaning he and his friend somehow had to acquire three cadavers roughly resembling the husband, wife, and child. The key word here was material. Mudgett foresaw no difficulty in acquiring the cadavers, although in fact a national shortage of corpses for medical education had by then driven doctors to raid graveyards for the freshly dead. Recognizing that even a doctor could not secure three bodies at once without raising suspicion, Mudgett and his accomplice agreed that each should contribute toward the necessary supply. Mudgett claimed to have gone to Chicago in November 1885, and there to have acquired his portion of the bodies. Unable to find a job, he placed his portion in storage and left for Minneapolis, where he found work in a drugstore. He remained in Minneapolis until May 1886, when he left for New York City, planning to take a part of the material there, and to leave the rest in Chicago. This, he said, necessitated repacking the same. He claimed to have deposited one package of dismembered cadaver in the Fidelity storage warehouse in Chicago. The other accompanied him to New York, where he lodged it in a safe place. During his train journey to New York, however, he read two newspaper articles about insurance crime. And for the first time I realized how well organized and well prepared the leading insurance companies were to detect and punish this kind of fraud. These articles, he claimed, caused him to abandon the plan and to jettison all hope of ever succeeding at such a scheme in the future. He was lying. In fact, Mudgett was convinced that the fundamentals of the approach had merit, that by faking the deaths of others, he could indeed fleece life insurance companies. As a physician, he knew no means existed for establishing the identities of burned, dismembered, or otherwise disfigured corpses. And he did not mind handling bodies. They were material, no different than firewood, although somewhat more difficult to dispose of. He was lying, too, about needing money. The owner of the house in Moore's Forks where he boarded, D.S. Hayes, noticed Mudgett often displayed large sums of cash. Hayes grew suspicious and watched Mudgett closely, albeit not closely enough. Mudgett left Moore's Fork at midnight without paying his lodging bill to Hayes. He made his way to Philadelphia, where he hoped to situate himself in a drugstore and eventually to become a partner or owner. He found nothing suitable, however, and instead took a job as a keeper at the Norristown Asylum. "This," he wrote, "was my first experience with insane persons, and so terrible was it that for years afterwards, even now sometimes, I see their faces in my sleep." Within days, he quit. Eventually, he did find a position at one of Philadelphia's drugstores. Soon afterward, a child died after taking medicine acquired at the store. Mudgett immediately left the city. He caught a train for Chicago, but quickly found that he could not work as a druggist in Illinois until he passed a licensing examination in the state capital in Springfield. There, in July 1886, the year Sir Arthur Conan Doyle introduced his detective to the world, Mudgett registered his name as Holmes. Holmes understood that powerful new forces were acting upon Chicago, causing a nearly miraculous expansion. The city was growing in all available directions, and where it abutted the lake, it grew skyward, sharply increasing the value of land within the loop. Everywhere he looked, he saw evidence of the city's prosperity. Even the smoke was proof. The city's newspapers loved to crow about the startling increase in the number of workers employed by Chicago's industries, especially meatpacking. Holmes knew, everyone knew, that as skyscrapers soared and the stockyards expanded their butchery, the demand for workers would remain high, and where those workers and their supervisors would seek to live was the city's suburbs, with their promise of smooth macadam, clean water, decent schools, and above all, fresh air, untainted by the stench of rotting offal from the Union Yards. As the city's population swelled, demand for apartments turned into flat fever. When people could not find or afford apartments, they sought rooms in private homes and boarding houses, where typically the rent included meals. Speculators thrived and created eerie landscapes. In Calumet, 1,000 ornate street lamps stood in a swamp where they did nothing but ignite the fog and summon auras of mosquitoes. Theodore Dreiser reached Chicago about when Holmes did and was struck by this landscape of anticipation. The city had laid miles and miles of streets and sewers through regions where perhaps one solitary house stood out alone, he wrote in Sister Carrie. There were regions open to the sweeping winds and rain, which were yet lighted throughout the night with long, blinking lines of gas lamps fluttering in the wind. One of the fastest-growing suburbs was Englewood. Even a newcomer like Holmes could tell that Englewood was booming. Real estate advertisements were full of testimonials to its location and appreciating values. Englewood, in fact, had been growing quickly ever since the Great Fire of 1871. One resident recalled how immediately after the fire, there was such a rush for homes in Englewood and the population increased so rapidly that it was impossible to keep up with it. Old railroad men still called it Chicago Junction or Junction Grove or simply the Junction for the 8 railroad lines that converged within its borders. But after the Civil War, residents grew weary of the industrial resonance of the name. In 1868, a Mrs. H.B. Lewis suggested a new one, Englewood, the name of a New Jersey town in which she previously had lived and which had taken its name from a forest in Carlisle, England, legendary for having sheltered 2 outlaws of Robin Hood stripe. It was here, in what Chicagoans called a streetcar suburb, that stockyard supervisors chose to settle, as did officials of companies headquartered in the skyscrapers of the Loop. They acquired big houses on streets named Harvard and Yale that were lined with elm, ash, sycamore, and linden, and posted with signs barring all but essential wagon traffic. They sent their children to the Cook County Normal School and went to church and attended meetings of the Masons and of 45 other secret societies having lodges, kingdoms, and hives in the village. On Sundays, they wandered among the velvet lawns of Washington Park and, if in the mood for solitude, the wind-blasted ridges of Jackson Park at the easternmost end of 63rd Street on the lakeshore. They took trains and streetcars to work and congratulated themselves on living upwind of the stockyards. The developer of a large Englewood parcel touted this asset in a catalog promoting the auction of 200 residential lots called the Bates's Subdivision. To the businessmen of the Union Stockyards, it is particularly convenient and accessible, and free from the odors that are wafted by the prevailing winds to the most fashionable localities of the city. Dr. Holton did die. Holmes made his widow an offer. He would buy the store, and she could continue to reside in the second-floor apartment. He couched his offer in prose that made it seem as if he were proposing the purchase not to benefit himself, but solely to free the grieving Mrs. Holton from the burden of work. He touched her arm as he spoke. After she signed the deed over to him, he stood and thanked her, with tears in his eyes. He financed the purchase mainly with money he raised by mortgaging the store's fixtures and stock, agreeing to repay the loan at a rate of $100 a month, about $3,000 in 21st century value. My trade was good, he said, and for the first time in my life, I was established in a business that was satisfactory to me. He put up a new sign, H.H. Holmes Pharmacy. As word spread that a young, handsome, and apparently unmarried young doctor now stood behind the counter, an increasing number of single women in their 20s began to patronize the store. They dressed nicely and bought things they did not need. Long-time customers also liked the new proprietor, but they missed the comforting presence of Mrs. Holton. The Holtons had been there when their children were sick, had comforted them when these illnesses proved mortal. They knew Mrs. Holton had sold the place, but why had they not seen her around town? Holmes smiled and explained that she had decided to visit relatives in California, something she had long wanted to do but could never find the time or money to accomplish, and certainly could not have done with her husband on his deathbed. As time wore on and the inquiries dwindled, Holmes modified the story a bit. Mrs. Holton, he explained, liked California so much, she had decided to settle there permanently. In the light blazing through the drugstore window, Holmes's eyes seemed bluer than ever. Becomingness. Nothing. There had been so much energy, so much bravado, but now, nothing. It was July 1890, nearly 6 months since Congress had voted to give the World's Columbian Exposition to Chicago, but the 45 men on the exposition's board of directors still had not decided where within the city the fair should be built. At the time of the vote, with the city's pride at stake, all Chicago had sung with one voice. Its emissaries had boasted to Congress that the city could deliver a grander and more appropriate setting than anything New York, Washington, or any other city could propose. Now, however, each quarter of Chicago was insisting on a location within its own boundaries, and the squabbling had stymied the board. The Fair's Committee on Grounds and Buildings had asked Burnham, quietly, to evaluate a number of locations in the city. With equal discretion, the committee assured Burnham and Root that ultimately they would direct the design and construction of the fair. For Burnham, each lost moment was a theft from the already scanty fund of time allotted to build the exposition. The final fair bill signed in April by President Benjamin Harrison established a dedication day for October 12, 1892, to honor the moment 400 years earlier that Columbus first sighted the New World. The formal opening, however, would not occur until May 1, 1893, to give Chicago more time to prepare. Even so, Burnham knew, much of the fair would have to be done by the dedication. That left just 26 months. A friend of Burnham's, James Ellsworth, was one of the board's directors. He, too, was frustrated by the stalemate, so much so that on his own initiative, during a business trip to Maine in mid-July, he visited the Brookline, Massachusetts office of Frederick Law Olmsted to try and persuade him to come to Chicago and evaluate the sites under consideration, and perhaps take on the task of designing the fair's landscape. Ellsworth hoped that Olmsted's opinion, backed by his reputation as the Wizard of Central Park, would help force a decision. That Ellsworth of all people should be driven to this was significant. Initially, he had been ambivalent about whether Chicago should even seek the World's Fair. He agreed to serve as a director only out of fear that the exposition was indeed at risk of fulfilling the meager expectations of the East and becoming simply a fair, as the term generally implies. He believed it imperative that the city protect its civic honor by producing the greatest such event in the world's history, a goal that seemed to be slipping from Chicago's grasp with each sweep of the clock. He offered Olmsted a consulting fee of $1,000, equivalent to about $30,000 today. That the money was his own and that he lacked official authority to hire Olmsted were 2 points Ellsworth failed to disclose. Olmsted declined. He did not design fairs, he told Ellsworth. He doubted, moreover, that enough time remained for anyone to do the fair justice. To produce the kind of landscape effects Olmsted strived to create required not months, but years, even decades. I have all my life been considering distant effects and always sacrificing immediate success and applause to that of the future, he wrote. In laying out Central Park, we determined to think of no result to be realized in less than 40 years. Ellsworth insisted that what Chicago had in mind was something far grander than even the Paris Exposition. He described for Olmsted a vision of a dream city, designed by America's greatest architects, and covering an expanse at least one-third larger than the Paris Fair. Ellsworth assured Olmsted that by agreeing to help, he would be joining his name to one of the greatest artistic adventures of the century. Relenting slightly, Olmsted said he would think about it and agreed to meet with Ellsworth 2 days later on Ellsworth's return from Maine. Olmsted did think about it and began to see the exposition as an opportunity to achieve something for which he had fought long and hard, but almost always with disappointing result. Throughout his career, he had struggled with little success to dispel the perception that landscape architecture was simply an ambitious sort of gardening, and to have his field recognized instead as a distinct branch of the fine arts, full sister to painting, sculpture, and brick-and-mortar architecture. Olmsted valued plants, trees, and flowers not for their individual attributes, but rather as colors and shapes on a palette. Formal beds offended him. Roses were not roses, but flecks of white or red modifying masses of green. It irked him that few people seemed to understand the effects he worked so long and hard to create. I design with a view to a passage of quietly composed, soft, subdued, pensive character, shape the ground, screen out discordant elements, and get suitable vegetation growing. Too often, however, he would come back in a year and find destruction. Why? My wife is so fond of roses. I had a present of some large Norway spruces. I have a weakness for white birch trees. There was one in my father's yard when I was a boy. The same things happened with large civic clients. He and Calvert Vaughs built and refined Central Park from 1858 through 1876, but forever afterward Olmsted found himself defending the park against attempts to tinker with its grounds in ways he considered tantamount to vandalism. It wasn't just Central Park, however. Every park seemed subject to such abuse. Suppose, he wrote to architect Henry Van Brunt, that you had been commissioned to build a really grand opera house,